Happy holidays and welcome to the NPR Movie Podcast for Thanksgiving week. This week we have a nice holiday spread of movie love all laid out, including Midnight Madness for the film Twilight, vampire movies for grown-ups, and a film about a group of Liberian women who fought for their country. But first, Kenneth Turan goes Aussie.
With a story this big, it's no wonder they named it after a continent. It's the circa 1939 story of what happens when Nicole Kidman's British aristocrat takes over an Australian cattle ranch and locks horns with Hugh Jackman. He plays a character who's so iconic, he's known only as the Drover.
Mr. Drover, I need to speak to you.
Now, where the hell are all the bloody stockmen, eh?
That's what I need to speak to you about.
Where's Fletcher?
We disagreed and I dismissed him.
Dismissed?
Yes.
Yeah. What about the cattle?
Well, it beggars belief that as he was leaving, he deliberately let the cows out of the, I don't know, whatever you call it, and they ran off.
Damn! Do you realize, woman, what you've done? I won't get another drove this late in the season, right? You've cost me my living.
Please, can't
but Australia is not just any blockbuster. It's filtered through the sensibility of director Baz Luhrmann, whose last film was the dizzying Moulin Rouge. Luhrmann is a lover of artifice and excess. Luhrmann also wanted to make a deeply Australian film, to bend the norms of Hollywood filmmaking to the task of telling the story of his own country, his own way. Australia pays attention to Aboriginal rituals and culture, and to the plight of the stolen generations, the mixed race and Aboriginal children who were removed from their families and raised in mission schools.
Help me, somebody, please help me!
You have to help her.
Help me! He's my child.
I understand what you're saying. You don't have an essential job.
No.
You must evacuate on this
boat. Don't let them take me away.
I will come and find you. Whatever happens, whatever it takes, we'll be together again. I promise.
I believe you, Mrs. Boss.
That boy, named Nulla, is the film's narrator. Nulla's life is hard, but he takes Judy Garland's Over the Rainbow as a kind of personal anthem. It becomes Australia's anthem as well, and its tribute to a place where dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Couldn't be a better fit for this big dreaming film.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. You'll find reviews of Gus Van Sant's biographical picture, Milk, plus Transporter 3 and more at our holiday blockbuster of a website, NPR.org.
The biggest fan frenzy since Harry Potter is swirling around movie theaters this weekend. In case you don't know any teenage girls who've been obsessing about Twilight, here's the deal. It's the first movie based on the extremely popular book series. It's about a teenager named Bella who falls in love with a sexy vampire named Edward Cullen. Beth Accomando from member station KPBS braved the throngs lining up yesterday for a midnight showing.
At the Edwards Mira Mesa Cinemas in San Diego, the crowd was pretty pumped.
When I say Edward, you say Cullen! Edward!
Cullen!
When I say Edward, you say Cullen! Edward!
Cullen!
Edward! Cullen!
That's Tina Peterson leading her fellow eighth graders in a cheer. They were among the hundreds of fans wrapped in sleeping bags, lounging in lawn chairs, and reading the Twilight book one last time. For Tina Peterson and her friends, they just had to be there for the experience.
Staying up till 12 o'clock and then seeing the best movie in the world.
Yeah. And we've been waiting for Twilight to come out since, like, summer.
Yeah, so 63 days.
We're pumped. Like, yeah.
We look on the website every day. And it's
We do.
And we have it on, like, our house, like, everywhere.
Yeah.
Just as, like, Twilight.
And yeah, posters.
Just look kind of obsessed.
Yeah. Big deal for us.
It was also a big deal for Leticia Robinson. Although no longer in high school, she could still identify with the teen characters. She showed her passion for the film by wearing
Twilight t-shirts, bag, necklace, pins.
From Hot Topic. Yeah.
And shirts that we made.
At a preview screening of Twilight, a group of teenage girls confessed that they had slipped out of school early to get in line. Krista Rowe could barely contain her excitement.
It's our life. It's just, it's everything but with fictional characters, mystical vampires and werewolves. It's just awesome. And they're all gorgeous.
Krista Rowe is quick to dismiss any criticism of Edward being cheesy and expressing his love for Bella.
All he's known is how to be a vampire. And it's like he says those cheesy lines But when you hear them, you don't think of them as cheesy. It's like, he doesn't know any better, so you're just like, wow, there means so much more coming from him. Because he doesn't think they're cheesy. He knows there's a meaning behind them.
Once they finally got into the theater, hearing those lines on the screen elicited this response from Krista and her friends.
Oh my gosh, it's hilarious.
That's Erica Hughes, an elementary school teacher from Chula Vista.
It's funny because you could tell that they really read the books, because when they really screamed was when they heard direct lines from the story. So I give them credit for having actually read a book.
Which brings us back to the eighth graders waiting in line for the midnight screening. They said their boyfriends came with them to make sure they didn't fall too much in love with Edward. But with or without boyfriends, the girls plan on seeing Twilight again.
Yeah, probably Saturday. We'll come back Saturday.
We're going to come back Saturday and see it.
But tomorrow we're going to sleep.
We're having a sleepathon.
For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
If you haven't heard that the movie Twilight opened this past weekend across the nation, well, you probably aren't a teenage girl or the parent of one. The film took in $70 million in North America over the last 3 days, the biggest Hollywood opening since Batman swooped into theaters in July. Ty Burr is a film critic for the Boston Globe. He says, if it's bloodsuckers you're craving, well, you should take a nibble on three other tasty options.
These are mighty dispiriting times if you're a follower of vampire movies. You know what I mean. Twilight, Twilight, Twilight. Enough already. Actual grown-ups are getting the vapors and swooning like teenage girls over the new franchise, and that can't be right. Anyway, it's not like this is a fresh development. Pop culture has been running twists on the Dracula legend ever since Nosferatu back in 1922. Here are three great revisionist vampire movies to make Edward Cullen look like he's still got his baby teeth. Let's start with Near Dark from 1987.
Don't suck.
In this hellacious drive-in classic, a redneck clan of bloodsuckers roams the Midwest in a van, visiting destruction upon unsuspecting biker bars. That's right, it's the first Red State vampire movie. It's also directed by Catherine Bigelow, the rare female director whose action sensibility is riskier and more low-down than any of her male peers. Near Dark has jet-black humor, but the scariest thing about it is the way Bigelow connects New World serial killers with the storied old world history of Nosferatu. This is gutter American Gothic served with precision and flair, and it has maybe the best vampire movie line ever, when Bill Paxton's trailer park creature of the night complains,
I hate them when they ain't been shaved.
Then there's 2000's Shadow of the Vampire, which asks the question, did you know the guy who played Nosferatu in the classic silent film actually was a vampire? Well, all right, he wasn't. But don't let a little thing like the truth stop you from enjoying a cheeky and very clever horror comedy. Willem Dafoe's character, a mysterious thespian named Max Schreck, introduces method acting a few decades ahead of schedule, biting into his role and driving director F.W. Murnau, played by John Malkovich, to distraction.
Schreck! What is the matter with you?
He's a Stanislavski lunatic. That is what is the matter with him.
All Murnau wants to do is make a brilliant movie. And all Schreck wants to do is live forever, on film. Well, that and using the crew as his personal studio commissary. Shadow of the Vampire opens up whole new avenues for vampire films. Can a meta-movie about Bela Lugosi's off-camera diet be far behind? And here's one of my favorites, Vampire's Kiss from 1989. A movie that features one of the great lost Nicolas Cage performances. Cage plays a pompous Manhattan yuppie who gets bitten by a one-night stand and comes to the conclusion that he's turning into a vampire.
What is happening to me?
Actually, he's not. He's just having a plain old nervous breakdown. But that's not special enough. So the delusional hero buys a pair of cheap plastic vampire teeth and sets about trying to kill people. All right, maybe this is more of a slapstick psychological case study than a vampire movie per se. Still, Vampire's Kiss is more consistently and entertainingly deranged than any other 10 movies you can think of, up to and including the scene where Cage eats a cockroach, live and on camera. Yeah, that's right. Top that, you Twilight kiddies. Unlike that teen angst blockbuster, these three old-school vampire movies make good on their promise. There will be blood.
Ty Burr is as pale as a vampire, but only from watching movies all day long. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe and the author of the book, The Best Old Movies for Families. Sing it! We will go by, go by!
Now let's turn to West Africa. For more than a decade, Liberia has been struggling to recover from a civil war. The new documentary, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, is the extraordinary story of a group of Liberian women who banded together to end their nation's second bloody civil war.
Liberia had been at war for so long that my children had been hungry and afraid their entire lives. Some say the war was about the gap between the rich and the poor. Some also say that the war was about the hatred between the different ethnic groups. Others say the war was to control natural resources, power, money, ethnicity, greed. But there's nothing in my mind that should make people do what they did to the children of Liberia.
Lema Bowie mobilized a coalition of Christian and Muslim women to stand up to Liberia's violent warlords and to the corrupt Charles Taylor regime. Ultimately, this unusual group of women helped bring peace to their war-torn nation. Bowie told me what motivated her to organize the women of Liberia.
War fatigue, not having anything to lose because you've lost everything. Being pushed so far back, physically, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, every way, that we had two options, succumb to death or fight back. And we decided to fight back, not in a conventional way of the cowards that we had as warlords, but as heroes and heroines, meaning we use our bodies, put ourselves out there, and conquer the evil force.
Talking about some unusual tactics to fight and to be successful with, one of them that you mentioned in the film was denying sex to men, kind of going on a sex strike. How did that work out?
Well, I must admit, in the urban area where I operated from, it was a bit difficult because every day we got stories of women coming back and saying, I had no control. But in the rural areas, it was really, really successful because the women, they had smaller communities. They were able to stay together and be together. So they were together for like months at night, keeping vigils, praying together. So they could keep it on for much longer time. But for us in the urban area, it was quite difficult.
Talk about that meeting that you had with Charles Taylor and what happened after you read your speech.
One day I'm sitting there on the airfield with the women under a blazing hot sun, and this security guard come and say, my boss wants to see you. And then I said, tell your boss I'm in my office. He should come down and see me. So he got out of his car, walked to me and said, why are you so disrespectful? Anyway, the president would like to see you all on so-and-so day. The thing was, Taylor was such a fearful person. No one thought that the women would come out in their numbers on that day. So we went and told the women to form a line. And they formed a line. And when this security guard just saw a sea of white marching, coming towards the place, he was like, oh my God. So on the way up to his office, they now said, the president is coming down to meet you all. He came down and they offered us seats. And we refused the seats and sat on the floor. And the people were asking, why did we sit on the floor? And the thing was, when we are running away from the bullets and the shooting and the fighting, we don't take chairs with us. We don't take beds with us. We don't take shoes with us. We don't even have food. So that was like symbolically saying you stop the war, our way of protesting to him. So after I actually read the statement that was given to me by instructions of the women, it was just an emotional time, not just for me, but for a lot of the women. I went to that meeting with a lot of anger in me. Seeing Taylor really brought it up.
Ms. Lema Bowie, coordinator of the Women Peace Building Network.
We are tired running. We are tired begging for bugger weed. We are tired of our children being raped. We are now taking this stand to secure the future of our children, because we believe as custodians of society tomorrow, our children will ask us, Mama, what was your role during the crisis? Kindly convey this to the President of Liberia. Thank you.
Now, one of the things you mentioned, the peace talks, that was one of the dramatic scenes in the documentary when you went to Ghana and you barricaded the site of the peace talks, and you even prevented some of the negotiators from escaping through a window on the side. Talk about the significance of that. Was that sort of the last straw, the last stand?
It was either that action or getting AK-47 and killing everyone else in that room. Because we had gone to Accra with the hope that we were there for 2 weeks. And it was 3 months later. 3 months of people getting fatter, looking good, warlords who looked like nothing when it came to that peace talk. And it was 3 months of constant bombardment of the city. Death, 200 death every day. Liberia is a country of 3 million people. If you have 200 persons dying every day, you know that you're depleting our population. So it was just painful. It was the last thing we could do. So barricading the hall, and then the security coming up to me and saying I was obstructing justice and threatening to arrest me. It was like, it can't get worse than this. So since I'm going to prison, let me just strip naked in protest of the pain that we are feeling, and in protest of what these people have brought us to, because they had actually brought the people of Liberia to disgrace, disrepute, whatever word you want to use. We didn't have any form of respect in the sub-region anymore. So one Liberian woman stripping naked was nothing as compared to what the entire nation was feeling at the hands of few persons.
What about the reaction of the women who were both in the film, who had speaking parts, who were a part of the movement, as well as those that we saw every day out in the field wearing white? We didn't hear from them. When they saw the film, what was their response to it?
It was very emotional. I saw the making of that film, and every time I watched the parts, the pieces that were being put together, I cried. And that was the same reaction with every woman who worked, who was interviewed, those who worked. Because for us, it was like unbelievable. We didn't know the magnitude of the struggle that we went through, you know, because it was almost like a struggle for life. You know, not that we didn't place any value on what we were doing, but it wasn't like something you planned to do. It was a survival mechanism. So looking back at some of the things that we had to do because our future and the future of our children were at stake was something that really, really took us back again to tears. And I think people, after seeing the film, went back with the feeling that this can never happen to the people of Liberia anymore.
The film ends on a very hopeful note with the election of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Is there still hope in Liberia now, today?
There is immense hope. And one of the things that I said initially when we started this work, my goal was to motivate women to step out and do something for their future. The elections of Ellen has motivated women beyond, has given them hope beyond what we ever thought we would accomplish in our work. So now my job is to create opportunities for those motivated women and girls. There's so much hope, so much possibility within that country right now, especially as it relates to the women and the youth of the country.
Lema, thank you so much. A wonderful story.
Thank you.
That was Lema Bowie, who's featured in the documentary Pray the Devil Back to Hell. She led a group of Liberian women to end their nation's civil war.
You can hear these stories and more on our website, npr.org/movies.